Now, what we've been looking at in this section, and we've got two more. We've got this Sunday and next Sunday in the Old Testament. Then we have a Sunday off, November the 7th. I think we have no class, right? Is that right? And then we start a new syllabus on the New Testament redemption, which is has some continuity with the old, but there's some new elements that show up. And if you've been following, what we've been looking at was trying to unpack what happened those couple of hours on the cross that Friday so long ago. We are the only world religion that celebrates the humiliating death of its founder. Okay, we are the only world religion that exalts, as Paul would say, in the death of its Messiah on the cross. Just a strange combination of the way one would approach the problem, let's put it this way, and we are unusual in that. And the reason that that's the case, obviously, is that for some reason God said this is what it took. You know, if I came to you with a problem and I said I have an itch in my left earlobe, and you said what you need is to have your right arm amputated to solve this itch, I would say, isn't that a bit of overkill? Isn't that an odd, isn't that exceptionally severe of a, you know, response to this itch on my earlobe? And I would say, now they would respond to me, who's the doctor here, you or me? And I would say, well, generally I'm not operating from what we would call a privileged epistemic position, meaning I'm ignorant. That's a philosophical talk for I am more ignorant than you might be. Okay. But I would wonder, and you try to explain it in medical terminology and things of this type, and if I was convinced about your credibility, and at the same time I was convinced about your care for me, I would tend to say, then I have underestimated the problem. I thought it was just a simple little itch, right? And this is where we come when we walk to the cross, and we sit there and see this amazing thing about this God enfleshed somehow, wrapped up in flesh, that goes and is executed in front of the whole world in the most ignominious of death after living a good life. You know, granted, he was a troublemaker to the religious authorities, but, you know, if you're worth your salt, you are. And then he died ignominiously, you know, and then his little band of followers deserted him that night, you know. Say, what was that all about? Right? It's a T-shirt we've mentioned before, you know, that you can find at little Christian bookstores. That's got a big old picture of the cross and the blood and everything up there. And it says, if I'm okay and you're okay, what was this all about? You know, and there's a basic message there that God says, this was what it took. Then you sit there and say, gosh, the problem was bigger than I thought. The problem was bigger than I thought. And what we're looking at is one aspect of the problem. We looked last year at the problem that was solved by the word sacrifice. And most of these terms are things that we don't use in the 20th century much. But sacrifice, we talked about, had to do with relationships that were positive and trying to repair those and grow those in a community context. And we're in this redemption word now, which has to do with trying to sever abusive relationships. Trying to sever those. And we started on page one, and I'm not going to review for the first 45 minutes like I tend to do, but on page one we talked about, and this will come back to the audience participation in a few minutes, so don't zone completely out here. The first four, we talked about the introduction, four real structures in human experience that give us problems. The first was the reality of oppression, that there are people that are trying to take advantage of us, or good motives or bad. There are oppressive. There is that element. There is violence in the world of various forms, emotional, physical, social, political, etc. The second was the reality of a consequence engine. Remember, God had built a system to where it cause is followed by effect. You reap and then you sow. It was supposed to be for leverage. It was supposed to be for good. And we have somehow would do the wrong thing and then try to get out from the consequence. So there's a consequence engine that says, if I do this, if I sow destruction, I reap destruction. If I sow death, I reap it, etc. And the third one was the reality of voluntary slavery. I could just get in such a pickle of a fix that I could sell myself and into an abusive situation. I was thinking on the way over here that of all the spiritual gifts I do not have, the one I miss the most is wisdom. Because if I had wisdom, I wouldn't get in situations where I'd need the gift of faith as much as I do. It's wrong kind of wisdom, but you get the drift. You know, that's the way the calculator mind tries to figure this out, right? That wisdom. But I get in these situations, as we all do, in these voluntary situations where, you know, I have forced myself somehow into an area of compromise and am caught there, just caught there, to where the lesser of two evils was bigger than it would have been as the lesser of two evils a day earlier, 2 months earlier, 2 years earlier, or 20 years earlier, right? And then there's the reality of alienation, the fact that things left to themselves move apart. They just degenerate, and we get further away from home and further away from friends and further away from warmth if you just sit there. If you don't do something constructively, back over and sacrifice, celebrate, things, and then you don't fit. You just feel isolated, and there's an element of alienation. And these are four very real things that we face throughout our lives, many of them all at the same time. Sometimes we get into our own alienation by voluntary means and things of this type. But this is the type of relationship that redemption is about. And so that word redemption in its specific context has to do with rescue from that somehow. Rescue from that by someone who cares in the Old Testament. And we've talked about, and we've come here to page 7. We've been going through how the word was used. And the big example of redemption in the Old Testament was what? The Exodus. So you're going to have to do better at this, because this is when it gets to participation. If you're this, I'll be answering all the questions myself, right? I know what you were going to say. You were going to say this, weren't you? Yes. Okay. But the Exodus is the big one. The Exodus is being snatched out of abusive slavery on the part of the Israelites, and Egypt snatched out, constituted as a nation, and put into their own home. Put into their own home. That's the paradigmatic, the example case, boom. Everything is measured by that. And there were all kinds of things that could be redeemed and bought and things of this type that we look at. But now we're at the common elements, the core image of this as we looked over this. And on the bottom of page 7, I've got a sort of the characteristics of Old Testament redemption. And it will be slightly different from New Testament redemption in 3 weeks. There are elements that are highlighted more when we move into the New Testament, but this is the backdrop to which the Jewish person would see redemption when Jesus would walk around and call himself the ransom for many. So let's look at the elements. The first was restoring someone or something to its intended status and condition. All right? A good example of that was the indentured servitude. So if I'm an Israelite instead of just a Southerner, and I don't have the gift of wisdom either, and I get in trouble, and I sell myself as a labor pool to somebody for 7 years, basically. I'm an indentured servant, okay, and I go and I live with them, and for a room and board, I provide some kind of labor, skilled or unskilled, depending upon my abilities. Sometimes I would be a scribe, for example. A scribe was skilled labor, and therefore the work wasn't quite as hard, so to speak. Okay, wasn't good on the eyesight because of lighting conditions back then, and they didn't have tables back then. So you wrote on the floor, basically, up until around 300 or 400 A.D. So it wasn't necessary. It was a little bad on the back, but somewhere with laying pipe kind of thing across the cities. So I would go in there, and I had to leave home to do this. I had to sell my land, and I had to go live somewhere where I didn't belong, away from my friends, away from my social circles, away from those that loved me, etc. And I'm just on assignment, basically. And what would happen there is that somebody would come and restore me. My brother, when he got his quarterly bonus, we use the example, he would come and buy me back out of that. He would pay for the labor, what the labor was, and then I would go with him and I'd go home. I'd go back where I could sit in my green easy chair, relax, be quiet. And I'd have to work the next day, of course, just to, you know, but that's not the same kind of thing, right? And the commute wasn't nearly as bad, you know, because I worked there in the house. But The scenario was, as I would be restored, someone or something to its intended status, because I was supposed to live there. That was my family inheritance and my condition. I was supposed to be a free Israelite. And so this aspect was about going home, about going back to where I belonged and where I could relax, where I fit, where I wasn't alienated. Okay. The second characteristic was that this redemption was by obtaining legal right over that someone or something. So in the case of a land, let's say I had to sell my property. And so I sold my property at rock bottom prices, and now it legally passed title to somebody else. Somebody else now owns that. And what I would have to do is somehow get legal right back over it. So there were a couple of situations on how I could get legal right. I could either buy it, like a land. I could go pay the redemption price. I could shell out shekels. Okay. And I have to see where that's from, that root and branch thing in the language, the shekels and shelling out come in. Okay. And I would do that, and I would obtain legal right over that. Okay. I could also get legal right by challenging the ownership in court. And we talked about it. I could go there, and I could be strong for the widow. I could allow the widow to have her land and the orphans by showing and being strong in court, paying legal fees and whatever else it took to make this happen. So I could redeem it by obtaining right over something. So when God plucked the Israelites out of Egypt, okay, did he obtain legal right over them? Yes, they became his people. They became servants of Yahweh, supposedly. Did he put them to work in the mines? No, because servanthood to God is more than the freedom of man. Okay, he's a good God. And he was a sovereign king, and so he brought out what they call vassals. That's the form of the treaty. The third characteristic is to which you are bound by kinship. In other words, this whole act in the Old Testament was based upon kinship, the fact that I was the brother, you know, that I had some family interest in this person that sold himself. And so, like I gave the example of when I sold myself in, my brother would go do this. It would not be, just a friend outside the tribe. It would be a brother. If I was killed and somebody had to avenge my blood to maintain tribal balance, it would be the brother. It would be somebody that had already had an investment in me as from a blood standpoint. Okay? So when God goes to pluck out Israel, they are already his people because of his covenant with Abraham. He's already got an interest. They're his people. I have heard the cry of my people in Egypt, is what he says. Right? They're already, there's a kinship there. There's a blood loyalties. There's a community that's already there somehow that redemption is based on in this particular case. Sometimes it's a community base as opposed to blood base. So when God is the redeemer in the Old Testament of the widow and the orphan, okay, and the alien, the oppressed, it's not a blood tie, but they're fellow community members. They're fellow community members. They share in the existence of the Israelite community, and that's their common bond. It wouldn't necessarily have to be a blood thing, because I, as a good Israelite, could adopt people. I could adopt aliens. I could adopt people outside my tribe in some cases. That would then be, I would be their kinsman. I could be their kinsman redeemer. So it was community-based, which ultimately boils down to loyalty and love, basically. That's what community was. You choose, and it's a loyalty thing, and then you love. And so, over which you are bound by kinship, or this loyal love, kesed. Four, either through, you, in other words, you bought them out, either through one of two things. The first one was either through investing personal resources of greater or equal value to the debt owed. So, if I, in some cases, if I sold some land, if I had to put up some land, the redemption price very often would be higher than its value. In other words, if I gave an animal to the priesthood and I gave it to them, if I went to buy that animal back to redeem it, I'd have to pay more than the animal was worth. Okay? And so sometimes the amount paid was greater than the purchase price of the individual. Right? What? Yes, handling charges, something like that. We don't know. Shipping and handling, fines, and no telling. But sometimes it costs more to pull that off. And so that was investing personal resources, and that could be either labor or capital. It could be money. It could be equivalent goods in terms of sheep sometimes. It could be replacing an unclean animal with a clean animal. There were a number of ways, but that was a capital. Or five, or through personal legal and forceful effort or greater or equal power than that of the illegitimate captor. So if you captured me in the ancient Near East and you took me as a prisoner of war, I could go redeem you by coming in with a superior military might and freeing my people. So I could attack the city and try to free you and redeem you by this effort that's greater than the defender. I could go, if you had stolen my people, Israel, and you had reneged on your contract to them as just shepherds and turned them into slaves and had violated this, then I would go invest my holy arm. I would just roll up my sleeves and I would go invest labor and resource and a whole number of things like that to obtain right of my people back, redemption, freedom. And that's a much more violent, it's a legal. It's based upon judgment. It's based upon judgment. Remember, in the case of if I sold myself as an indentured servant to an Israelite and my brother decided to redeem me, there was no animosity between my owner and my brother. My brother, you know, there was no animosity because there wasn't any abusive treatment involved, right? It wasn't against my will. I was the one that sold, right? And I'm the one getting fed. And so there's no negative thing there, as opposed to in the case of this one, where Pharaoh's there oppressing the people and won't let them go. Just makes it worse as they encounter him. See, there's a violence element there. There's an element of strength. There's an element of moral outrage at inhumane treatment, etc. Okay, so five was through personal, legal, and forceful effort. Six, often removing them it from abusive, adverse, and unavoidable treatment by a superior. So this is the from. When you have redemption, you have a for and a from often. And the from, in the case, if I sold myself as an indentured servant, okay, it may not be, abusive or adverse, because it'd just be a standard working relationship. But in other situations, it might be abusive. It might be, you know, less pleasurable, let's put it this way, than living in my own home and being able to just enjoy some peace and personal quiet. So often it is to pluck them out of a bad scene, pluck them out of an abusive situation that was unavoidable. Even when I voluntarily sold myself into it, I might not have an opportunity to remedy the abuse or anything like that. So it often the redemption removes it from a bad situation. And finally, seven is and or from a dispossessed alien situation. So this was a situation that we started this discussion with. If I sold myself out of my homeland, I sold myself to somebody else, I'm an alien over there, I don't belong there, and I'm often brought back home. So these are the structures, the core image that are in there. And the basic element is a rescue or a redemption. It's a rescue, but with a cost. See, it's not just a rescue, but it's a rescue based on kinship, and it's a rescue based on cost. So those are your elements that you've got in there, is that there's a compassion element, there's a loyalty element, there's a covenant element already in there, and it's not a simple transaction. It's not a simple transaction for the agent that redeems you. Okay? All right. Now, next page. There are those four things that we read again about the four reasons, the four basic structures. Now we come to audience participation. Okay, this is D. We've got 17 passages to work through as a group, and here's how we're going to do it. Look at the little handout we gave you called Factors of Old Testament Redemption. If you have your handout and you don't see any writing on it, you're looking on the wrong side of the page, turn it around. Okay. There are five things, and we're going to divide the class into five sections. It's not a group discussion thing, but these five facts, we're going, this will be section one over here. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through each one of the passages, and you look at the passage and come up with the answer to question one. And this section right here will be question two. We'll go through the questions in a minute. This will be three. This will be four. And the back row will be five. Okay, that's the punitive one for sitting in the back. Okay. So we're going to go through, and it's not a group discussion. You just sort of shout out your answers, you know, as to what you see there. The first question is, from what state was the subject redeemed, and what was bad about that state? So you'll look at the passage, and you'll say, what situation was the person in, or the group in, that they needed to be redeemed from? Okay, what was bad about what that situation was? Now, all five of these won't be in every verse. So if you have glazed eyes on one of these, and it's an appropriate glaze, let me know. We'll pass over that. But they won't be present in all of them. But we'll try to, and these are the basic structures here. So the first one was, from what state was the subject redeemed? What were they in? What trouble were they in? And what was bad about the state? Then how did they get into that state? Did they sell themselves in? Were they captured? Did they just stumble into it? Was it because they were alive, you know, that they got trapped like this? From whose authority or domination were they redeemed? In other words, who was the superior? Who was the captor? Who had legal right originally? And it's a little harder for this group. You also have a second question, part two, is what type of adversary was it? Was it oppression and capture? Was it the consequence engine? Was it voluntary slavery, or was it alienation? Those four things we've talked about. Just what kinds of problem was it? Four was what was invested by the redeeming agent. So if I go and do the purchase, was it money? Was it labor? Was it legal action? Was it fighting? What did it cost me as the redeemer? And then the back was, where did we end up? What was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed, unto or for? If they said we were, like in the New Testament, it says we were redeemed that he might purify us as a people zealous of good works. See, that's a redemption unto something, or redemption for something. Okay, and so what was the resulting state? Where did I end up? I got to move back at home with my brothers. Yeah, that's a resulting state. I got pulled out of the furnace, iron smelting furnace of Egypt, over and plucked into the promised land. That's a state. So those are our basic five structures. And the reason I want to do this is because when you get into redemption, when you get into the need to use an imprecatory psalm, okay, and you're going to appeal to God for redemption, pull out your chart. Right? Pull out your chart, work through this with him. Lord, here's where I am. Okay, here's where I am. Here's how I got here. Okay, that's a separate, that may be a separate discussion you have with him, ending in confession. After you've worked through the blame, through the thing about how did you let me get here, God, after you finish getting through that issue and you get into the, as the proverb says, a man's folly ruins his life, but his heart rages against the Lord. I just love that, boy. Love it and live it. That's what, yeah, okay. Three was about, here's the adversary, here's what I'm facing. It was either wrong that I did, and here are the consequences, or wrong somebody wants to do to me, or whatever. And fortunately, the cost of the, I need some intervention, God, or I just need forgiveness on the basis of the cross. And then what was the resulting state? Here's where I'm trying to get, Lord, as best I know how. As best I understand what a good place is, this is where I want to be. We are often wrong there. But this is the structure that we want to understand, that this is what redemption is all about. Okay, the first one, let's look at the first one. Okay, so the first one is, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. So this is, this is on his deathbed, basically. Jacob is talking about the future for his children. He's doing last will and testament kinds of things like they did. And the old Israelites, they issued it as prophecy, basically. They did blessings on each one of the tribes, in some cases judgment on some of the tribes. But he gets up there and he worships on his staff, and he says, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. Now, the angel is generally understood to be the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, which we understand to be the pre-incarnate Son of God. Okay, that's our general understanding of the angel of Yahweh, because the angel of Yahweh is divine somehow, and is still separate from Yahweh in heaven, and that's how we get early notions of the Trinity. We're sort of stuck there in the Old Testament. We've got an angel that's called Yahweh and has all the attributes of deity, but somehow talks to Yahweh and represents Yahweh. You know, we're just sort of stuck. We run out of metaphysical capital at that point. So the first one is the angel who has redeemed me from all evil. So the first one is, from what state was the subject redeemed, and what was bad about that state? Any ideas over there?
Famine
was one. They went through famine a number of times. Remember, they ended up in Egypt. So that was a bad state.
Laban.
Laban's another one. See, this is one of those blanket statements that you can say at the end of your life and cover a whole number of evil things, right? Because that's what he's saying. Laban was one. Remember the treachery, the constant disloyalty that was shown there, and abusive treatment. That's another one.
The wrath of his brother
Esau. That was through that whole venue there with all of the patriarchs. You've got constant infighting. There was constant infighting and treachery. And what were the bad things about those states? What could have happened to them? He had treachery from his sons. Remember, if you remember, this is the one whose dearly beloved son, remember, was killed by the others. The 11 sold him into slavery. We're going to kill him, then decided to sell him into slavery. The oldest one tried to rescue him, but the oldest one had already fouled up pretty bad by some incestuous things. And so just not a pretty sight at all. Not the way you would hope your kids would necessarily turn out. There were a number of things at this person's life that somehow God had gotten them through. Had God stopped these things from happening? The answer is both. Some he stopped. He stopped Esau from killing him, the earlier one. Okay, but did he stop the bad things from happening most of the time? No. Did he get him through? Yeah. So what does the angel who has redeemed me? See, redemption is not who stopped it from occurring. Redemption is when you're in there. Right? I'm going through hassles now, many of you know, and I read the end of Peter all the time, where it talks about, there's a little section where he says, now I'm the God that, you know, you're suffering now for a while, but he will restore you so that you'll be strong, firm, and full, or something like this. And I keep thinking I'm in that pre-restored state. Therefore, I'm fragmented, unfirm, unstable, etc. So it explains my condition, right? But I'm in that pre-restored state, and that's that redemption thing about being redeemed. They're in that state. And you can imagine the turmoil. Well, we don't even have to imagine the turmoil over the loss of Joseph. Remember, we have recorded how he felt. He was going to go down to his grave in tears. Remember? I mean, we have a father's lament there. We have that experience there. Okay, so how did they? How did Jacob get into that? Into those various states? Sometimes it was just by being there. See, this wasn't necessarily. We don't know. It's not always a parent's fault. Not always, you know. In spite of our best self-abuse. Sometimes you live next to it, right? Sometimes you live next to it. And some of the ones that we didn't mention, of course, is there was constant threat from the Amorites, the neighbors. You know, I mean, the stories of the patriarchs, they having to deal with the kings that were always fighting, there was always danger. And the danger was related to where you lived. In the New Testament, we know exactly where that is. We live right smack dab in the middle of the world. Right, that doesn't like us at some level, at a fundamental level. Okay, so how did they get in that state? Was basically just by living. It's not explicit in the text, though. Three, from whose authority or domination were they redeemed, and what type of adversary was it? There are a number of answers here, obviously, because of this scenario.
Power of Sheol,
peril of the grave, that constant destructive force that tried to just keep killing everything in its way. And that would be like both an oppression, there's an active element in death that's out after us, and then there's the consequence engine. When we just do something wrong, if we sow sin, we're supposed to reap what? Death. Romans 6 is relatively clear there. right? What other kinds of authorities might have Jacob have had to deal with? There's one actually real good one about the remember where he lied about his wife thing. You know, he did the like Abraham. Remember, there was an authority. It was the famine thing, and he got in trouble there. No, there's something wrong about that. That's not him. That's not him. That's Isaac. Yeah, this is Jacob. And we would have had, would we have had any voluntary slavery on his part? Under Laban. See, Laban, he went and he did a contract, right, for the bride. Right, he was going to work instead of pay the capital, and so he put himself in a voluntary situation there, and he theoretically could have gotten out of that on a breach of contract law back then, right? But he had too much invested personally, and he had no place to go. He had no place to go. He couldn't go home because he was expecting to be killed the second he stepped over the border. Remember the fear and trembling that he went through, and we think, you know, from an exegetical standpoint, that one of the primary things he's thought about here about the angel was that encounter when he went home. Various patriarchs have to go through this, but sometimes it's the angel. They cut deals with God, you know, that appear with him at various shrines, and they say, if you'll protect me, you know, then I'll set up a shrine here. And they try to get through this. So authority and domination. What was invested by the angel in this case? Most of the time, it wouldn't have been money. It would have been protection. In other words, they would have gone in and reversed situations that would have stopped. A good example would be the case of Joseph, right? So how would God have redeemed Jacob's feeling about Joseph's loss, right, had he not been there? What would they have done to Joseph had God not been superintending there? They'd have killed him. They'd have killed him because the vote was 10-1. There was only one that wanted to save, and majority ruled back in those days, and so they would have killed him. But now they talked him to throw him in the pit. He appealed to greed, said we could sell him and get something for him. So that's noble compassion. That's a good kinsman redeemer. running in opposite. Yeah, we can get something for this one, right? And then the back rate, what was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed unto or for? Again, this is a little vague because we've got so many incidences. But if you reflect right where he is at the time that he's doing this, at his deathbed, what was the resultant state? He lived that long. He saw his kids. He saw his kid, the coat of many colors that he thought was dead, right? And at this particular point, his family is getting food. His family is somehow provided for, right? And so these are the kind of structures. Let's look at the next one. This is a law. And you talking about the Israelites, shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey. And if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons. Now, this is the basic Levitical law that says if you have your firstborn son was judged like there was in Egypt, and therefore there should be a judgment upon them, but you're supposed to redeem that son by some sacrifice. So I'm not talking about the animals here, but I'm actually talking about the redeemed of the son. That's the passage we're looking at, redeeming the firstborn son. So they were supposed to either give, the firstborn son was supposed to be given to the priesthood to serve all the time, but under judgment, but you redeem them by paying some price for that. Okay, so from what state was the subject redeemed, and what was bad about that state? We're talking about the firstborn son. What would they have ended in? Where would they have been had redemption not occurred, basically? They'd be dead. They'd basically be dead. Or under some understandings, they would be servants of the temple for all their lives. Because sometimes, like when Hannah gave Samuel to the Lord, right, he just stayed there at the temple and served the whole time. And so they didn't get the advantages of having that son. Okay? So there, from what was death, how did they get into that state? How did the firstborn son get into that state? Yeah, by lying. Yeah. Yeah, right, exactly. By lying. Firstborn son got in there by being born, just being there, you know, just being there, and being the firstborn son. That's how you got into that state. If you weren't redeemed, of course, you got into it because of things that happened before you. The Exodus, the judgments on Israel. See, that's how you got there. From whose authority and domination were they redeemed? It's the same answer you had earlier, by the way. Sheol. Same thing as from death. That's who they were redeemed from, was judgment. The judgment that fell on the firstborn of Egypt, see, was postponed for the firstborn of Israel. See, and God says, I'll give you a way to deal with this. See, because he's unfair and he's impartial in his judgments. All the firstborn were judged. All of them. And he just elected, used grace and his authority. He had flexibility in his authority as to when he visited judgment upon those. Yes. Yeah, and they would have gone out, right? Anybody that paid attention would have gone out. And remember, so many of Egypt's officials, you know, right there toward the end, sat there, looked at Pharaoh and said, "You're crazy. Don't you know Egypt is ruined? We've lost it all. I mean, we don't have a." But Pharaoh said, "No, no, 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 no." And so in one case, remember, I anticipate that some of the officials of Pharaoh did this because in the earlier livestock destructions, you know, remember some of those people went out and got their cattle in from the field and put them in the stalls. You know, somebody's catching on here. Even a monkey learns to duck. Remember. Right? And they go through this and they say, click, I got this one. There's a pattern here and a trend line that says, go put these in the stall. So I anticipate that there were, because we know that there were a number of people that when Israel left, they weren't pure Israelites. There was a mixed multitude, and then they were also what they call the rabble in earlier translations that murmured and sowed dissent and things of this type. But there was still a completely converted group of Israelites and probably other Asiatics, Canaanites, that filtered through Israel as well. But yeah, good question. Good question. So from death, for what was invested by the Redeemer? So in this case, the parent that redeems the child, okay, what was invested? Money. In this case, it was shekels. It was basically shekels. And then the resulting state of the firstborn son in the back was what? Life. And in the context of this, it's the absence of judgment, too. Because before the redemption, you're under the judgment that fell upon Israel. So you are doomed at some level. You are marked out for death, right, by virtue of that position. And then all of a sudden, when you're redeemed, you're out from under the judgment. You're free, free and clear. Not only are you just alive, you're not subject to that judgment, okay, whereas you were before. Okay? Three, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. Remember, that's Glenn again, gets in trouble, sells himself, indentured servant. Okay? Unlike when we get to the New Testament, we have chattel slavery in the Roman Empire. Over in the ancient Near East, as a servant, indentured servant, I could own property. I could have my own property. It was no big deal. And I was just a hired laborer, basically. Okay? And so here, either my uncle or my brother, whoever could come either buy me, or if I did really well, you know, making money as an individual and my share of the profits and things of this type, I could buy my own self out and go home. Okay? But I could do that. And that was built into the law. So that as God would prosper me, as I would come to my senses, perhaps I could buy my way out. Okay, so that's the example. Okay, from what state was the subject redeemed, and what was bad about it? Indentured servitude. And what was bad about it, actually? Lack of freedom is another one. It has to do with where I have to serve. Remember the alienation. I got to move away from home. I'm away from kinship. I'm away from my close social ties. I could be on the other side of Israel. Ain't that far, what I understand, but still it is by walking standards, right? When you go home, you're not at home. So the state, and that was part of the bad. It was a restriction on movement, restriction on activity, freedom of choice, things of that type, but also alienation. I just wasn't at home. How would I have gotten in that state?
Bad planning.
Bad planning. That's right. Bad planning. That's that trend line thing, you know. If I wouldn't have put the sheep in that thing, you know, I'll end up there for sure. That's how they got into that one. From whose authority or dominion were they redeemed? The master, the person that bought me for the six years. Basically, that's whose authority they were under. What type of adversary was it? Voluntary slavery, right? And it could also be a consequence change. Remember how these interrelate. Because the consequence change could be my bad planning, right? Got me into this bad situation where I had to sell myself into voluntary slavery. So some of these things work together to thwart me. That type of adversary. What was invested by the Redeemer?
Money.
And whose money was it?
Mine or my family's.
Absolutely. And what was the resulting state in which the subject was redeemed unto or for? Freedom and going home. Right. Freedom and going home. And going home and freedom were part of the definition of Israel. See? Every Israelite under his vine and under their fig tree was the standard definition of the peace and prosperity of Israel all the way through 500 years after Jesus. This is the way they defined peace in Israel, where they had the little home lots, and I had my little farm, and I had my figs, and I had my vines, and maybe a little strawberry. And I would sit there, and that was what peace and prosperity was all about. It was kinship, and while the crops were growing, and you couldn't do anything because you didn't have insecticides or anything back in then, you visited and you celebrated with your family. You got caught up on the gossip, and everybody knew what everybody else was doing. Close-knit communities. And when there was an upset in the community, everybody got upset about it. Everybody. It's community. Real community. So that was what the state for. That's why it was important. Okay, 5. And David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, and said to them, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all distress." Okay? So David's not in a good place here. We skipped 4. Okay, that's a consequence engine problem. Okay. Absent-minded professor. 4. Okay, but because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers, the Lord brought you out by a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Okay, so this is Moses telling Israel before he dies, "I'm going to remind you about what God did. I'm about to give you all the rules of the covenant, but you've got to understand where we start from, why we even have this covenant. Doesn't have to do with you earning God's favor. It starts with what God has done for you. It starts there. Obedience is supposed to flow from gratitude, love, and affection. Right? Because the Lord loved you and kept the oath." Okay? So here's the Israelites being redeemed from the house of slavery. So what was the state? From what state was the subject redeemed? Right. Slaves, oppression, infanticide, no straw for the bricks, oppressive treatment, unreasonable management demands. Okay. And that's fairly clear what was bad about that state. That's pretty clear. How did they get into that state? That's interesting. Did they do anything to get into that state? They voluntarily went down as shepherds so they could eat. Right. And they had freedom and they had a privileged treatment. They got the best land, Goshen, okay, at the time. They didn't have to mess around with the nasty Egyptians by their standards. Right. They were separate from them. They had autonomous government for the longest time. So how did they get into that state? Times changed. Overstayed their welcome. They should have left earlier. That's right. They got a little too prosperous. What this was, if you think about it, is this was a change of management. That's exactly how they got here. Pharaoh changed. Another king arose that knew not Joseph, right? And so how much of it was Israelite fault? Very little. We don't know actually how much of it was, but probably not much of it. Yes. Well, you got a couple of elements there. There we have an intense case of the providence of God. Remember, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. There were other ways God could have got them down there. That's fairly obvious. You know, that didn't have to go through the treachery of these brothers. But if he was going to allow the treachery to grow, he said, well, I'll just layer on top of it the deliverance of the whole world. You know, I'm going to pull good out of bad. And then he's also going to reconcile the brothers. He's going to eventually turn them into more godly than they were before they went down there. So he's always, when horrible things happen, one of the things I always pray is that God would swirl that into his sovereignty. That when these horrible, or what we call horrendous evils, when they occur, just pray that God would, and this, that's not theologically precise, you know, swirling it into his sovereignty kind of model. But it makes sense to me that God will produce more good out of it than the bad that was done. That he will redeem it. That he will redeem it. And in the case of that, he specifically had told Abram, you're going to go in there and it's okay. You know, they've had a number of things like that. Where it was sort of okay for them to go down there. There was a blessing. They wouldn't have gone had God not forced them to go to keep them alive. And that was part of why he said he sent Joseph ahead. All right, good question. So how did they get in that state? They were just there. They were there. Times changed. And once we get to the New Testament, we'll see that actually even later in the Old Testament, you can see this pattern that what's happened is that there's a change of attack upon the nation. The nation is always being attacked at some level by the forces against God. And it's especially intense prior to the coming of the Messiah, prior to the Montgomery. There are a number of attempts upon Israel's life, their heart, their religion, their worship, their relationship with Yahweh throughout Old Testament history. And this is one of them. This was one of them. You kill all the male sons, the nation dies, basically. The nation's going to die, and it would assimilate into Egypt. All right, how did they get in the state? From whose authority or dominion were they redeemed? Pharaoh's, okay. What was invested by the Redeemer? At what cost or price? Who was the Redeemer of Israel from this, first of all? Yahweh, God. And what did he pay? What did it cost him to do this? A couple of answers here, actually. The Scripture calls it what? First, his rolled up arm, his effort. And we talked last week about some hidden aspect in his heart. No pleasure in distress. He has no pleasure in the death of the wicked. He doesn't like to do judgment at all. Okay? He's not in the judging business. Right? And so there was an element of cost of that would have been also grief, but just he just doesn't like destruction. He just doesn't like it. But the cost in the Old Testament that's given is that of his effort that was involved, revealing himself in the sight of the nations and things of this type. Okay, that was what was invested, and what was the resulting state of Israel, and what were they redeemed for? Right, they were redeemed to be a nation for God. They were supposed to be a kingdom of priests, remember? They were supposed to be free, and they would be specially protected by God as their sovereign king, their suzerain. Okay, and so redemption for them was to result in a freedom, not an anarchy. I mean, it had rules, it had structure, but all the rules and structure were meant to build community, build love and health and care for one another. Even though there was work to be done all the time, it was supposed to be good work. I mean, can you imagine going to an office in a world in which dwelled righteousness? Fully righteous? It would be amazing. But anyway, so that's what they were called to be. Well, we didn't get through all the way through this, did we? Okay, well, do the rest at home.
yeah, right.
We'll do some more. We probably won't do them all. I'll pick out some more so it'll keep you guessing which ones if you pray or prepare for next week. Because we do want to get to the conclusion if we can next week. We're not in any terrible hurry here. But I did want you to see, like I said, the structures. So when you look at redemption, you see how there's that element of rescue and what it costs, and you start thinking about that when you run across the word redeeming and redemption in reading the Scripture. So let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you that you are the Redeemer, that you did indeed, out of your love for us and your commitment to us, you broke into history, you bared your holy arm, and you revealed yourself in the person of your Son. You did a redemption price. Somehow his death accounted for that. We'll see that in the New Testament. But even here in the Old Testament, we can see your heart. We can see your heart is for your people, for those that you have loyal commitments to, those that you have befriended, that have turned to you and cried to you, that you show yourself strong for them, and that you act the role, and you play the role of the kinsman redeemer, and that you do break in, and you provide the resources to move us from that bad place to a good place. The psalmist said, "You have moved me into a wide and spacious place." And Father, we pray that this day and this week we would reflect upon that. Your heart, your redeeming heart, your rescuing heart, your loyal heart, your loving heart, and your active loyalty, that we might turn to you with our hurts and our state of affairs that are not particularly good, and we would bring them to you and say, would you visit this with redemption? Would you buy me out of this? Would you rescue me from this? Would you plead my cause? And that we might cast our cares upon you because you care for us. We pray this for the sake of your Son, in whom your heart is so clearly revealed. Amen.